It's Destazapod back after a nice little break. I got lots of questions to answer. Everybody's talking about Fallout as of this moment. A couple Fallout-related questions coming up. I really like it. I think it's a good show. I think I'm not all the way through yet. I think we have one or two episodes left to go. But pleasantly surprised. Didn't really gel with the first episode, but it does grow on you. I think the writing is really strong. I think there's some great characters in it. They kind of did the impossible. They pulled it off. And, you know, this is sort of coming from Amazon, who, in my opinion, really bungled The Lord of the Rings. I couldn't even get through the first episode of The Lord of the Rings. It was so egregious to me. But it seems like they found footing with Fallout. Maybe because it doesn't have quite so much baggage or easy comparisons to another far superior motion picture series. But I really dig it. And, you know, I'm happy that people are sort of thinking about Fallout. On that note, why don't we tackle these Fallout questions? We got one from Timothy Wilkins. Do you think the Prime series will bring a new group of fans to the Fallout Mega Merge figures? And will that pique their interest enough to send them down the GLaDOS rabbit hole? And then from Thomas Bucci, would you attempt to revive the Fallout Mega Merge line with Just Toys, continuing where the line left off, getting the unreleased wave of figures? So for the latter question, no. If that was going to happen, that would have to be undertaken by Just Toys independently. Not to say I wouldn't, you know, if they wanted to rehire me to consult on that brand and they wanted to sort of re-engage the royalty deal for using the GLaDOS pegs, sure, absolutely. But I know McFarlane has the license right now for the show. You know, I don't know that it's a feasible thing to happen. But ultimately, it's really up to Just Toys. That was just contract work for me. While it was a very meaningful project and I was happy to be able to participate with it, I really didn't control the pulleys and levers of the larger decisions that went with that line. So I think that's probably a better question to ask Just Toys. Regarding Timothy's question, is this going to sort of renew the interest in the Mega Merge line and get more people into GLaDOS? I can say anecdotally, I've had a couple new customers that have purchased the Fallout figures that are on my store. And they've also, you know, picked up a couple of the Knights of the Slice figures and are sort of learning more about this. There was this Reddit thread that popped up not too long ago where somebody had just randomly discovered the T-51 armor. And they didn't even know there was a toy line. They didn't know anything about GLaDOS. And, you know, it became a pretty popular thread, and it pushed a lot of new customers to my store. And a few of them, you know, like I said, bought some other things. And I think one or two of them might actually have jumped on the Patreon as well. So hopefully it does. You know, I think it's a great rabbit hole to go down. You know, I'm super happy for the time that I got to spend with the Fallout toy line. I would love to see it continue in some way, shape, or form, even if I'm not involved. And, you know, I'm eagerly awaiting Fallout Season 2. Moving along, a question from Brett Barnacle. What's your take on the resurgence of O-ring toys? An avenue worth exploring? If so, any recommendation? You know, actually, I just had a couple figures come in from Strike Force Alpha. I believe this is Delta 17 or something like that. I wasn't actually too cognizant of this line, but I saw someone posting some pictures and I said, hey, why don't I check these out? And I gotta say, really good construction and quality control on these. Now, late last year, I got these sort of Zika Toys O-ring figures, and the quality control on these was really poor. They're very loose, the accessories and the limbs don't really stay on. You know, not a real sort of professional presentation. And that kind of made me gun shy about sampling other O-ring retro figures. But then I got the Skeletron figure, the Red Skull. And that was really good, really dialed in, really excellent quality control. And then I took a chance on these Strike Force Alphas, and again, really nice stuff. So I'm sort of conflicted in how I feel about the resurgence of O-Ring. It does certainly tickle the nostalgic brain for me, and I do like O-Ring as a format. I think it's a lot of fun, and there's a lot of personality and character with it. But I think it is also indicative of us just running out of ideas completely. Because an O-Ring is an inferior sort of construction or toy compared to something like, you know, the sort of vintage series of Hasbro for Star Wars, right? Not the retro one, Hasbro and their Star Wars branding, they have a lot of issues with not clearly communicating what size, what scale, what features their lines have. I digress. A vintage collection figure with all of its articulation and its really excellent sculpting and, the whole kit and caboodle, that is a far superior form to something like an O-Ring that is going to be limited by the technology of the time and by the sort of clunky mechanisms for the articulation. But that's not to say there aren't scores and scores of people that love and appreciate the O-Ring. It is just an antiquated, outdated thing at this point. I'm glad they're here. I think as the generations roll on, nobody's going to give a shit about O-Ring. It's going to look more and more like this, you know, again, very antiquated, old-fashioned thing. There'll probably be some standard torchbearers for that format, but largely, I see this resurgence of O-Ring as kind of one last party for all of us aging collectors. But doesn't mean we can't find joy in it, so let's celebrate it. There are some good lines out there worth tracking down. Next up, a good question from Gordon McKinnon Hall. What are some of your favorite Mexican bootlegs? It's an aesthetic I'm very into, but I don't have any yet. I have to be honest with you, the biggest piece of advice I can give you about Mexican bootleg figures is to actually not collect them. I save and print out every photo of every figure you see that you like. But the sad reality is these are made with subpar plastic, and oftentimes you will get sticky or greasy figures. They will start to deteriorate almost immediately. There are different standards of manufacturing in Mexico for these bootleg markets than there are for China and the sort of Western market in many respects. So that is my biggest piece of advice. Now, I went to Oaxaca many years ago. God, it must be almost 10 years ago at this point. And I had a wonderful time. Oaxaca is an incredible place. It's indescribable, but beautiful climate, beautiful architecture, wonderful food, and tons of these sort of flea markets and stuff like that. So I went hog wild and bought so many different Mexican bootleg toys. I bought so many of them, more than I could ever ship back to myself. And, you know, these are basically the equivalent of 50 cents or a dollar each. Pretty cheap purchases. I think we covered this on Toy Pizza. I'm struggling to figure out what episode, but you can go back and look at the archive. We've definitely featured some of the Mexican bootlegs that I did end up bringing back. The one that I still have that is in very good shape and has not had any paint chipping or any sort of melting is a comic book Bane figure that also included a removable head for a Tom Hardy Bane, which I think is ingenious and obviously something that could never happen due to various licensing issues and legitimate product. But it's so cool, it's so big and clunky. It's only got like, you know, 4 or 5 points of articulation. But it's wonderful. And to me, it's kind of a work of art. It's outsider art in many respects. There's also been some really bizarre ones. Like there's a light up clear translucent Joker, and it was just kind of like a generic superpowers Joker. And when you pressed a button on the back, it had this very, again, generic sort of disco lights that you would find in maybe a cat toy or something like that. There's so many crazy, insane ones. There was a clear blue Iron Patriot Iron Man figure. And Iron Patriot was not at that point, I think, in any of the MCU movies. So it was, again, like a comic accurate sort of sculpt. And I don't know why they made it clear blue, but that was another cool one. There's scores and scores of them. I think maybe I may have a Flickr album of a lot of these. I'm going to have to do some research and see if I can find it. But, you know, that is a rabbit hole that could truly occupy you for the rest of your life, because there is no accounting for all of this, right? These are productions that are done fly by the seat of your pants, and a lot of these operations shut down and close and, you know, rename themselves and pop up elsewhere. There is no end to the amount of bootleg product that's been made in those markets. And it would make for a very fascinating but very frustrating sort of collection process. I am episode one pilled. I admit it. I've given into this absurd obsession I have. I've talked quite a bit about episode one in the recent past. And I think largely because it's kind of like the 25th anniversary. And I'm just sort of like, I don't know. The mind tends to get nostalgic, right? You hit a mile marker that kind of really warps your perspective of time and things moving in a linear path. And you realize how long it's been. And, you know, I'm a very different person from where I was at age 19. And I'm thankful for the path I've taken, but it does sort of, you know, it makes me contemplate all these things. And one of the things, one of these theses that, a thesis that I've been rolling around in my head is that I think time sort of ended in 1999, as I knew it, right? And as I think a lot of people sort of perceived their lives and perceived Western power and perceived America, I think it all kind of, the beginning of the end was 1999. And there's all these confluences of things that happen. But you have The Phantom Menace coming out. This is the first Star Wars film in, since, you know, 24, 25 years earlier, right? Another interesting bookmark. This 50-year span, we're sort of like, you know, breaking down this time barrier that way. You also have The Matrix that comes out, that it was an incredibly prophetic film. Not just an entertaining film and a blockbuster. Also a very... a film that really leaves an impression if you're 19 years old and kind of floating around and have, you know, don't really know what it is you're supposed to be doing in life. And I think, you know, all of this was kind of the last call at the bar before 9/11 happened, and this new century kicked into full gear in an incredibly destructive and negative and satanic way. So I've been going back and watching the making of episode one and episode two and three. And, you know, it's really fascinating because they knew they were in trouble pretty early on with what they were trying to do. And, you know, there was so much that, much like the state of America at the time and reality at the time, there was so much excess, right? You see that these VFX artists were really, like, thrown under the bus to just tackle really impossible things. But truly, the problem with episode one was just the writing and the story and the characters, right? Everything that George Lucas sort of spearheaded, those were the fundamental flaws that really could not overcome any sort of marketing hype or... you know, product rollout or any sort of excitement or enthusiasm. Nothing could get beyond just having an interesting story with captivating characters that you wanted to follow around. And so I was sitting at Shake Shack the other day waiting for a burger with a gluten-free bun. Beautiful day outside. And I had my sketchbook with me, and this idea of episode one was just burning a hole in my brain. I couldn't quite escape it. And I just started sketching this idea, you know? I remember reading a Starlog magazine around, like, 1990 or something like that. And they talked about episode one. And they said that it starts off with Anakin as a slave, and he crushes the windpipe of his slave owner with his mind, and that sets into motion everything that happens in the prequels. Now, I don't know if this was somebody writing into Starlog completely full of shit, or this is an actual draft of, you know, an early sort of Lucas outline. But that always stuck with me, and I thought that was interesting and fascinating. And they kind of have a little bit of that in The Phantom Menace, but like most of the storytelling aspects of it, they completely bungle it. So, all this is to say, like, I have an unhealthy fixation with The Phantom Menace right now. And it's produced this very silly little comic strip that I think serves a couple different purposes. But one, I think it goes to show that you just need a very simple, good story with interesting characters that have some kind of conflict and have something they want, right? Now, the artwork in what I'm doing with the Ep 1 alt is purposely bad and quick and sloppy. That is always going to be the sort of the mode in which I prefer to do my storytelling, because I want it to be automatic and instantaneous and impulsive and get it out to the audience as soon as possible. But even with all of the flaws of the visuals, I think people are genuinely entertained and get a chuckle or two and want to see what happens next, right? And I think that's more than you can say for the entire prequel trilogy. There is a lot of stuff to like, and there's a lot of things you can kind of pick out, but you really don't like any of the characters. You really don't find any of them particularly humorful or insightful, and they don't really want anything. And it's not a journey worth sort of anticipating or wanting to see what happens next. So if I'm doing anything with this little Ep 1 alt idea and project, hopefully it's communicating to people that all you have to do is have a very good story, have a good idea, have good characters, and you can get people to want to see more, right? It doesn't matter how terrible the art is or how sloppy the marker is splashed on the page, or if it's in an inferior presentation like, you know, a blog-like style of Patreon. If you can just hit those little key elements, you can kind of hook people and get them to anticipate more coming down the pike. You don't need the magic of ILM. You don't need, you know, beautiful lifelike 3D renders. You don't need any of that shit. You just have to be able to tell a story that's easy to understand with charismatic characters that want something. You know, I think that those are kind of the universal things that work when it comes to world building or storytelling or things of that nature. So I hope you've enjoyed this exercise. I don't know how many more I have left in me. I'm just kind of doing this day by day as it feels inspiring or interesting. Once it doesn't feel inspiring or interesting, I'll probably let it rest. But I'm happy that people have been along for the ride and gotten some level of enjoyment out of it, because it's very puzzling for me too. I'm not sure why my creative energy is manifesting in this way, but that's the way the wind blew me. Getting back to questions, we got a good one from Brendan from Zed Star. Listening to the DestazoPod archive, you mentioned working in licensing often. What's the day-to-day like for a licensing gig? It's a lot of legalese and contract drafting, or other creative slash fun elements to the jobs? Any big wins or examples? So I'm working a little bit in licensing currently. You know, I've made no bones about the collector's market really slowing down, and so I've taken on outside work. You know, I need a job too. And a good example for Natalie Korematou, we have a cosmetics deal coming out soon. In this case, it's a big cosmetic company who shall not be named, but they want to utilize some of Natalie's artwork on some gift with purchase promotional items to inspire people online to sort of purchase their stuff. And it's a great deal. The money's decent. So for me as a licensing agent, my priority is protecting Natalie and her intellectual property, making sure that a contract is not erroneous. It's not going to get her into trouble later. There's not unreasonable terms. They're going to pay the money they've promised. So when I approach the opportunity, you know, I get on the phone with the cosmetic company and I want to know how long they're going to run this promotion, how many units they're going to make, what is the compensation for the artist, how is that compensation paid, when is that compensation paid, and who owns the artwork that is being generated. Are they using some of her older stuff? Are they just licensing a previous design? Or is she creating something new? And amongst those factors, you kind of get a feel for, you know, if the deal is fair, if it's not. You know, if somebody's designing something that's going to be on 100,000 t-shirts and you're getting paid $10,000, well, you can do some simple math and figure out you're not making very much on each unit that is exploiting your talent and your idea. So I guess a lot of, you know, the sort of day-to-day for a licensing agent is talking to partners, finding out what they want, protecting your client. I was always very strict about getting deals papered as soon as possible, getting signatures on deals and getting advances paid. I do not like to have a big gap of time in between those things happening. And any company out there is going to slow walk every single step of that process. A lot of product gets made while things are still being negotiated contract-wise, and I don't like that. I don't think it's a good methodology of business. Now, going back to the Stryker Entertainment days, based on how hot your properties are, your day can look very different. But during the heyday of something like Twilight, my day was wall-to-wall conference calls. And because I was in New York City, Stryker HQ is in LA, I was a little better positioned timing-wise to deal with the European markets, which in licensing, I have a lot of experience in international markets, probably more than I do domestically, I would say. So I would get up relatively early and start calling or get on, you know, my conferences with whatever partners were in the European Union or wherever, just to benefit from the sort of time difference. Because by the time I wake up, their day is winding down, and I want to have all that stuff out of the way, you know, by noon, 1 o'clock, when LA starts to wake up, so that I have updates for them, I have action items for them, things of that nature. But when your brands are really in demand, it's kind of a nonstop train. You're really like blowing through conference calls, making deals, getting paper signed. A lot of, as you pointed out, legalese and contractual reviews. You're always looking for any changes that people are making to contracts. During the red line process, that's when the wool tries to get pulled over you. But the fun stuff was really like the movie premieres, getting to go to Cannes Film Festival. Some of the meetings at the studios were kind of fun too. Like I went to one meeting and Brendan Fraser was sitting in the lobby waiting. This was Brendan Fraser before his sort of rediscovery, but I found it so odd that I was sitting there waiting for a meeting and getting to go right in, and Brendan Fraser was sitting there just like a normal guy, just being iced out by the reception at a movie studio. That sort of stuff was fun. When I was in my late 20s and early 30s, I traveled a lot to Europe. I traveled to Brazil. I traveled to a lot of different international markets. And for that time of my life, that was great. That was a lot of fun. I went to London a lot, went to France, Bologna Book Fair. I got to go to Sweden. Like, I got to see the world and I got to sort of sit in these meetings. And when you represent a studio that has a hot property, you kind of feel like you have a little bit of juice. You know, people are very nice to you. They want to have the meeting. They're seeking out your business. So you feel like, you know, a popular girl before prom in some respects. But all of that is a facade. It all melts away, the second you release a bad film or, you leave the industry. You don't get to take that juice with you. So to recap, the day-to-day for a licensing agent is a lot of contractual reviews, a lot of phone calls, a lot of negotiating certain points, a lot of paper chasing, a lot of making sure people are wiring the money that they owe, royalty reports. It's a lot of paperwork, but there are fun things that you get to do. I found the deal-making process. I found sitting down with people, going to Vegas licensing, stuff like that was fun. I think I was good at it. I was good at sussing out what people wanted to achieve and how to find a workable solution between what I knew the studio would allow. And also, I think I have a relatively good bullshit detector. There's a lot of underhanded people in licensing and in manufacturing and promotions, and it helps to have a good bullshit detector because there's tons of people that, are Nepo babies or in their position for whatever reason, and they're not good at their job, or they have very underhanded motives for what they want to do. And, it helps to kind of be able to spot a hustler in those scenarios. But in any case, it was a lot of work. It was very lucrative work. I think fondly of it, but I'm much more happier doing what I'm doing. Next up, we got a question from Great Greebles Wacky Workshop. What's your favorite dinosaur, flying reptiles excluded? That's an easy one. And you thought you were going to trick me with excluding reptiles, but not going to work with me, Great Greebles. Argentavis. Argentavis is a magnificent beast. It is a gigantic bird of prey. And it's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. You should look up the Argentavis. You should look up a human compared to the Argentavis skeletons that they found. It is really quite stunning and quite stark. And I think that's my favorite one. Now reptilian-wise, I do have a soft spot for Ankylosaurus. I think those are quite a bit of fun. There's so many, honestly. I could go on and on. I'm not going to. We got a lot to cover. But thank you for the question. Argentavis is the answer. Next up from Matt Connolly, with Rex in the hand of the Spice Fleet and rumblings of the Trilobite King possibly revealing himself, would Vaughn be wary that Rex could be carrying a xenomorph version of the Trilobite Menace? It's a fantastic question. I always like when people are paying attention to the little hints I drop. As I posted on Patreon, there are a couple things that are going to get resolved over the course of the next couple months, probably culminating in Toy Pizza Expo. Some of those things are what I call a Trilo reveal. Also, we have confirmation that Rex has touched down on Earth. He has been brought here by that sort of rogue Spice Fleet squadron. Now, he's going to have to go through a debriefing. There's no question. This has been an extraordinary thing. Also, I think it's completely rational to ask the question, is this the same Rex? Has Rex been manipulated in some way? What are we getting? Is this the old lovable Rex Gannon, the indestructible man? Is this a facsimile? Is this a clone? Is this somebody with mind control? Any number of things could be happening here. So, Vaughn and Lady Beowulf and Jessica, they're going to have to be super careful. They're going to have to fight every instinct to sort of embrace this person and really do their due diligence and make sure that Rex is cleared. And that's a big question, and we're going to get to that in the near future, no question. The other thing that's worthy of note, I've been hearing a lot of rumbling about the world governments and more so the corporation machinery out there. It's well known that the Trilobite King is able to control the minds of organic things, human beings. Typically, he has used the Trilo masks to sort of control people. We saw, you know, Cro-Mega fell victim to this. He was once a beloved, benevolent leader, and he became something quite twisted. Now, he was able to break out of this hold, but it's very clear that the Trilo King can control the minds of Earthlings and of humans. And this is very concerning. This has been a concern since the battle for Pangaea Island. And I'm very concerned with what the sort of superstructure and power has come up with as the answer to this. So if the human mind is susceptible to the Trilobite King's psychic attacks or control, their counter to that is a machine's mind. The prevalence of AI being inserted into a sort of robot warrior, for lack of a better term. This is, I think, an erroneous step. This is a very bad move to make. You're sort of taking another genie out of the bottle that we may not be able to control. We can probably get around the Trilobite King's ability to control minds. Certainly we can stay away from Trilo masks. That's easy enough. But, you know, it's not clear if there's a sort of telekinetic link he can make, or his control can be exerted without those masks. So I think the world governments and places like Fred Foods Inc., they're really going down what I believe is the wrong path to empower more sentient robotic creatures as a security force. I think is going to backfire immensely. I've heard a report that in Harbor Noir, which is completely crime-stricken, right? It's really gotten bad there with the sort of suit man gang control and a lot of various factors fighting there. They're now thinking about experimenting with a human AI hybrid mind, right? They want to sort of take somebody and do this. I think they called it the RoboSen protocol. They want to do this experiment. They need to find like a cadaver of sorts, and they want to merge these two minds together. And based on how that goes, they're going to sort of see if they can achieve a fully sentient but controllable AI robotic unit. I don't think any of this is a good idea. I think all of this is going to backfire 100%. Sure, we have issues with the Trilobite King and his influences and his little cold wars that he's kicking off here and there, but we might undermine humanity altogether by investing too much faith and too much research and development in this idea of a sort of robotic, skeletal, sentient. There's probably some clever acronym they're going to come up with. But in any case, I don't think any of this is good. I think this is all no bueno. I don't want to see this happen. And I think, you know, we're going to be in even deeper trouble if something like this, you know, comes to fruition. So let's just be aware, do your own research, but that's where I'm coming from. I don't think any of this is good. Next up, a question from Gavin Rader. I'm hungry for dolls. Any more of those accessory sets coming down the pipeline this year? So a credit due to Gavin, because he did inspire me to run a separate dolls accessory set. Those are the sort of blaster and the little creature and the face mask for the Sen unit. It was a great idea. I ran it. It was part of the Action Figure of the Millennia for this past month. Unfortunately, I have sold a total of 4 of them. Now, granted, patrons got this accessory set already with their mailing for AFOTM, but that is an exceptionally low number for anything that I put in the Patreon store. Typically, you know, my Patreon audience, not everybody's a member of the club, so there's 100+ people that like to go and visit the store and pick whatever they missed. There have certainly been people buying the sort of Bughead head pack and the blank body for, not blank body, but the sort of headless body for the Vice Bug. Next to nobody, I think 2 to 3 people have purchased the dolls head pack separately. I'm going to put it in the public store. I'm going to add some of the unpainted divers and stuff like that. But that is a criminally bad turnout for any accessory that I've run. I don't want to say that precludes me from ever running it again, but it definitely makes me incredibly gun-shy, because typically my patrons are my alpha customers. They are a good indicator of what will sell when it gets to the public store. They are my biggest sort of active customer base. And if there's a pretty tepid reception to that on the Patreon store, I anticipate it to probably be relatively cool in the public store. And that does really affect my ability to order them in the future. Now, as part of a Franken-slice, that's a little more reasonable than the sort of heavy lifting of getting that item sold does not rest solely on the accessory pack itself. So maybe as accoutrements to a different figure, they could have a future. But as a solo item, so far the indicators say no. Moving over to the Top Secret Discord, you can absolutely join this Discord by being a member of patreon.com/JesseDestasio. By the way, we got a question I didn't answer on the previous pod from Dorothy Zbornak 74. I know Toy Pizza Expo is more than about buying things, but I was wondering, will there be any expo exclusives for those who can't make it in person? And yes, of course, there will be a bundle deal available long before Toy Pizza Expo. If you want to pay ahead of time and pick it up, we can also work that out. And I think, like previous years, it'll largely be blind. So you're taking a leap of faith here. But I got to tell you, I've put more time and energy and thought into this collection for Toy Pizza Expo. And it is going to blow your fucking mind, okay? It really, really will. I don't want to say much more than that. But it is a very cohesive offering, and I think people are really going to dig it. So I'm very much looking forward to that. Moving along from the Robot Assassin, what other kinds of enemies do you want to see in Helldiver 2? I'm perfectly content with how Helldiver 2 is. I'm probably not going to spend much more time playing the game. I kind of cycle through games in about a, 30-day, 60-day window, more or less. And I'm very eager to get to play Demon's Souls, which I've still never played. I think it's a perfect game. I love it. I'm having a lot of fun. I'm getting very good at it. But I think it's okay being what it is. You're either fighting mechanized robots or you're fighting bugs. You go with your buddies, you shoot everything, they explode. It's a great formula. I'm not sure it needs much tinkering beyond that. I think it's a pretty fulfilling experience. Two Deer adds to this, have you checked out Earth Defense Force? I have not, but it is on my to-do list. I know that is another title that people hold in high regards. I do think there's something very interesting, and maybe this manifests in the storytelling of Knights of the Slice at some point, but there is something great about just destroying giant bugs. And also, there is something great about the storytelling of, like, the Terminator universe, mechanized death machines, skeletal automatons. Like, there's so much to love there. And, these are sort of other vibes that I have going on alongside this episode one obsession that, maybe all of this culminates into something. It all kind of gets itself worked out through Knights of the Slice anyway. So these are very interesting ideas. I'm having a lot of fun playing the game. Also, by the way, guys, I don't think I mentioned this on Destazapod, but Cray is officially in production. I wired a shit ton of money, so much money that it makes me nervous for my future. And the project is underway. This is extremely, extremely exciting stuff. So the Sea of Daggers is a go. The deposit has been paid. I believe we're going to be taking a look at tooling models. I guess in a few weeks, a little less than a month, I'm going to get to take a look at these. This also means, hopefully, I will be able to get over to Hong Kong and possibly China as well and give patrons a first-hand behind-the-scenes peek at everything that's going on. You're going to see the entire process of Kray and its development and the Sea of Daggers. And, you know, I think it's starting to get me excited, dare I say. I try not to get excited about these projects until they're here in my hand, but, I got that tingle. I really do. And while we're on the topic of crowd-funded figures, like the Sea of Daggers and Kray, I want to remind everybody to go check out and go back Mighty Maniacs Dark Earth. These are some very cool fantasy figures from our friend at Rock'em Toys. I backed on day one, and I want everybody else to. I want every Glios project to succeed that's out there. I think it's important for all of us that every Glios project succeed. We are in an extremely precarious and bad time for independent creatives. So let's make sure we're getting out there and we're supporting the community and supporting the other makers. And this is a great example. And I, for one, as has been pointed out, I think by Kenneth West, the new characters mixed with Kray's new legs might be an incredibly explosive combination. So I'm looking forward to checking that out as well. I always like putting the Mighty Maniac figures with Hackerman or Radic legs. I think the proportions work really well. So it'll be nice to have some more building parts for that. And the weapons look pretty damn cool too. So go check that out on Kickstarter. Let's make sure this gets funded and blows through its goal. Next up, we got a question from Jeremy Price. This is a good one here. The HasLabs Giant Man figure will be run at roughly 13,000 units. Is that a scarce number for that market? And do you imagine it will be hard to come by on the secondary market? These are great questions. I think, you know, Dowdy and I have this theory that there are about 10,000 toy collectors, adult toy collectors, largely in the U.S. We think that that is relatively the ceiling for the market. Now, something like a HasLabs offering is going to have some level of speculators and flippers, and, you know, that would certainly comport with our sort of estimation about how many people like ourselves are really, like, plugged in and exist in the world. It's not millions of people, for sure. Now, this discounts quite a few different things. We're not talking about people that might purchase or collect Funko Pops casually. We're not talking about somebody who may have a Dragon Ball Z statue that's, one of their prized possessions. We're talking about, like, really people, you know, like ourselves, really tapped in, reading toy news every day, backing Kickstarters, making pre-orders, watching HasLab streams, you know, being omnivorous in our collections. We think that number is about 10,000 people, and it's largely located 98% in America, right? If we sort of zoom out a bit, I think we can get to maybe 20,000 toy collectors like this sort of A-tier collector worldwide. But, a lot of other countries just do not collect and consume the same way that Americans do. It's really a highly centralized on America and the United States and sort of our spending habits. So I don't think actually the Giant Man is being underrun for the demand or for what the market is. I think that that's actually a pretty healthy number. I think getting your hands on a Giant Man or getting your hands on any HasLab offering is about how much you're willing to pay. Because HasLab stuff does seem to appreciate. I had the barge. I was able to offload that for quite a handy profit. The person I sold it to also made a profit on their reselling of it. I think it's really... I can't imagine that there won't always be listings for Giant Man on eBay. The question is, are you going to want to pay the prices that are sort of being offered on it? If you really want to think about things that are low run, right? The toys of the GLaDOS universe are historically some of the lowest runs that have ever happened since the history of plastic manufacturing. That is due in part to our great relationship with the factory owner and the fact that we tend to kind of order as a family unit, if that makes sense. So if a factory needs to make 10,000 pieces of something to make a profit within a 30-day span or whatever the case may be, collectively, all of the different GLaDOS artists probably can't do 10,000 units of anything, but together we can kind of hit that number. It's just split amongst different molds and different styles and things like that. So while we don't really talk about our production runs, that is proprietary information, I can assure you a lot of the O'Neill and greater GLaDOS community member figures are absolutely some of the most historically low figures ever run, ever. Now, will these appreciate to the level of something like a HasLab? Probably not. It's probably only meaningful to the people listening to this podcast and the larger, GLaDOS community. But historically, I think it's pretty unprecedented what we're able to kind of get done here. So if people are interested in scarcity and things like that, you're already collecting some of the most obscure, randomest, lowest run figures on this earth. Okay, that was nice and easy. So all the questions have been answered. I will bid you adieu. I hope everyone has a lovely weekend. If you happen to be in the Beacon area, we are doing a last-minute concert tonight at Quinn's, opening for the karaoke jam, which is always a fun time. So that's everything. I'm going to leave you with a song about riding an Argentavis. This is Redwoods by Zed Star 7. Pizza out.